Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from. A curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther Teague.
Hey.
Hey, buddy.
How was your Thanksgiving, man?
Man.
You spent it with your granddad and a turkey?
You know, that was my tradition for years. Nice. That was my tradition for years. The inside joke there is that for about a dozen years, I would spend Thanksgiving. It's not a sad thing, but I would spend it alone. It was a day that I took for myself, but I would spend it with a bottle of Old Granddad and a bottle of Wild Turkey so that I could deflect the questions. People would say, oh, come over to our house for Thanksgiving, or you know, you got nobody in town, come to our house. I would say, no, I got a turkey and my granddad. It's going to be great. So it was like a little camouflage. But for the past few years, I spend Thanksgiving out on Long Island at Dale and Jill DeGroff's house. And that's like, it's like being on the Partridge Family. Like, eventually Jill will start playing the piano. Dale will accompany on his guitar. There's a few songs. There are games that are played. You know, the big Rockwellian turkey comes out. And, like, it's the most surreal and wholesome event that I do all year for sure. Like maybe even it may eclipse the wholesomeness of my life. So it was great. And what'd you do? I see you're in Vermont on your Instagram. Were you there for Thanksgiving or just after?
No, I went there.
Cause we took a week off the show. Day. So I haven't seen you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, sure. Sure. I missed you, buddy.
Me too, buddy. Oh. The genius of social media means I feel like I'm hanging out with you all the time.
I get that for sure. I went to a bunch of different things on Thanksgiving. Popeye Extra Fancy for their thing. Thank you, Danny Neff, for inviting me to that. Went by Tiki Adams Place. Always a great, very wholesome time as well. Then I headed up with my buddy Justin Lane Briggs, who's been on the show before. Yep. A couple times. He works for Skernick, bartender. Just popped up there to Vermont. Never been to that part of the world before.
That shocks me. You seem like the type of person who would really enjoy Vermont.
Well, I ride choppers, so my gas tank is really small, so I can't really go that far before I have to like refuel a bunch of times. So
sure.
Also, it was snowing. So I got to go to Vermont and hang out with him and his mom, Karen. Happy birthday, Karen. It was yesterday. And got to check out some really cool spots. We were in Burlington and Winooski, which I realize is the Onion River, which is awesome. A river of onions. Like, it's like someone just throwing a Gibson at your face.
You yeah, know? Yeah.
But
a river of Gibson.
Yeah. But I actually got to go by a couple of cool places. Went by the Mad River Distilleries, like Outpost in Burlington. Met Neil, who's the secretary of secretary or treasurer of USBG in Vermont. Oh, cool. And then went by a place called Waterworks and Winooski, that like it's like right on the river. It's a beautiful, big, beautiful restaurant and bar. It's an old mill that's like on the river, and it was just like so cool, man.
It's
like
it's pastoral beauty up there, like that's for sure.
Yeah, totally, man. And like, and also there was another birthday being had that it was on Saturday night. The guy who runs the bar program there, Sam Nellis, he such a great bar staff and a great bartender. It's like it's just cool to see, like, you know, like. You know, we talk about this a lot on the show. It's like we live in this little tiny bubble. And even like Justin and I, when we're driving back to New York City, kind of begrudgingly, actually,
right?
After being in all that zone, you know, we're like, man, it's like there's like even so much that like we live in this tiny little bubble in New York City. There's like stuff that's happening. Like Justin's about to move to like City Island on the Bronx and stuff. And it's like, dude, there's stuff happening everywhere, you know. It's like I say it all the time, it's like big beautiful world despite all the politics and religion and all that bullshit. It's like some fucking cool shit happening, man, all over the place. And like we're very lucky to be like living in this time where there's so much progressive culinary and mixology vibes that are happening in these different places. I mean, shit, I was in Montpelier where you went to culinary school.
Where I taught at culinary school.
Where you taught at culinary school,
right? I went
right?
to culinary school in San Francisco.
Yeah, right. But then you taught at NECI.
Yeah.
Which is the New England Culinary Institute.
You got it.
So, yeah, we were hanging out there. We went to Charlie O's.
Yep. When I was there, it was one of the only two bars in town.
Yeah.
Yeah. Smallest state capital in the country, Montpelier.
It's crazy, man. It's crazy small.
Yeah.
It's adorable.
The daytime population of the town more than doubles based on people going to work. But at night, it's 8,000 people.
It's insane.
there are 8,000 people on my block in New York.
What did you do? Like, how did you end up there?
I mean, you know, that's when I was a chef down in New Orleans. And
so you went from, like, the hottest place to the coldest place, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I hadn't worn a pair of pants in 3 years. And then I
moved. Were you wearing at least shorts? Or?
I mean, most of the time. And then I got the call to move up there. I'd never been a sight unseen. I took the job because it was a job of some prestige at the time. I arrived in Montpelier, Vermont in August, where it has on record snowed in August. So I went from like the armpit of hell to the, you know, the witch's teat, as they say. Like, oh, it was Mr. cold. I started a burgeoning plow business. No, I taught up there for almost 2 years. But speaking of culinary school grads and whatever, our guest today also went to culinary school. And look how he turned out now. He's in the bar biz. We got Micah Melton of where do you live now? Are you Chicago or New York? Which are you?
New York for the time being.
And you're here because you came over to open the office.
Right. So the office opened late June, and then we just opened the aviary portion the end of September. So I've been here a little bit before June, just kind of getting everything set up, but here through the end of the year, and then going back to Chicago when it's brisk there.
Yeah, so. It sounds like a good time of year to go back to Chicago. Right. So let's talk about, goddamn, you guys are, I mean, the aviary, it's massive.
You have heard of it.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's like a crazy, crazy program that has won like all the awards.
Sure. If there's an award, they've at least gotten a nod from it.
Exactly. So, like, let's talk about, I mean, I want to get into that, obviously. I mean, we should definitely talk about what we do on the show a lot of times. We talk about how you got into it. I mean, you went to culinary school, but you were also a computer programming major.
Right.
Like what the fuck? Who the fuck are you, man?
Give us some of your background leading up to where you're at now, and then we'll dive deep into what you do now.
Right. Yeah? So I guess when I was just getting out of high school, I was kind of terrified to move to a big city. And so I
let's start there. Where'd you go to high school?
Davenport, Iowa. So, so it was not a small place. It's definitely bigger than Montpelier, but we're about 300,000 there. But at the time, I thought that when you went to culinary school, you had to move to New York and go to the CIA or go to Kendall in Chicago or whatever. And I didn't research that well and just kind of followed what the rest of my family had done. So I went to college at University of Iowa, computer science. And absolutely hated it and dropped out and kind of blamed it on the school and I guess more of the path because I thought I wanted to like make video games and you know what kids want to do when they're 17 nowadays. and so I ended up dropping out and then moving to a more technical school and doing computer programming. And
I have to say that sounds like if the one wasn't good, how did that sounds worse.
it's a little more hands-on and I took a college calculus class with my sister who's 6 years older than me and way smarter than me because she was getting her master's, so she had to go back and take some of the same classes as me, and that's when I kind of realized I was like, wow, I really don't like school, and B, I'm really hate math, so like what am I doing
out of your depth way yeah. out of your depth all of a sudden,
right? So I moved schools and it was a little more involved on what I actually thought I liked to do. But then, you know, at one point I kind of just like looked at myself and was like, do I really want to sit and stare at a computer screen for 40, 50 hours a week? Like to a certain extent, yeah, like to play the video games, but not necessarily to work on programming or whatever like that. So I dropped out again and then finally realized that like I should just go to culinary school. I always had a passion for it and always liked it and started working in restaurants and bars around that time. And so I just went to culinary school, kind of back where I was familiar. So I went to school in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It's called Kirkwood. It's actually a really good program. It was a community school, but they had just built a hotel, which was attached to the school. So the program was like kind of up and coming, and it was really good. I didn't actually make it all the way through again, so I dropped out 3 times. I always joke that my mom's
a charm.
Yeah.
My mom's really proud of me for that. But, you know, at the time I had a job offer from, you know, one of the best fine dining restaurants in Iowa, which, you know, doesn't mean anything now. But at the time, you know, like, I guess the experience for me was more valuable than the piece of paper. So,
I mean, you know, when I went to culinary school myself, and frankly, I don't tell a lot of people this, but now I'm about to right on the air. I kind of regretted it. And then for years after going to culinary school, I would talk to people who would say, oh, I think I need to go to culinary school. And I would say, don't. Right. I would say, get yourself a moleskin and a pin. Go get 2 jobs. Work at one sort of, you know, junky place that's crushing through a lot of volume. And work at one nice place. Do both those jobs for 6 months and quit
Absolutely.
Them. Quit them both.
Right.
And then do that again. Do that 4 times and you've got your 2-year degree if you take notes and ask questions.
And you get paid.
And you get paid. Yeah. Right. And then, of course, I got recruited to teach at a culinary school and I changed my tune for 2 years. Just call it very important. You got to go.
Right.
And then I don't work there anymore. And I go back to this theme. So I get it. Like dropping out and going and getting the actual price. Because it's not like being a lawyer or a airline pilot. You don't have to go to school
right.
to be a chef.
But I also find it interesting, if we back up for a second, that, and as you guys both grab your beers very with, like,
if
ferocity.
You're
going to
talk, I'm going to drink.
I find it funny, like talking about like staring, because I was a graphic designer and I got really bored with like staring at computer screens all day.
Right.
And to me, though, you were talking about gaming, and to me, work is kind of the game. Like going through a service is kind of like, it's kind of a game, you know?
For sure.
Like when you kind of navigate your way through it and you come to the end, and if it's successful, then you're like, all right, I win. You know, like,
and picking up coins the whole way, bling 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 bling.
Totally. But yeah, I mean, and like, it's just a different kind of gaming, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Anyway, but sorry.
That's all right. That's the observation that is life these days. Like we all, I think there's a part of us that all, you know, we have so many screens in front of our face all the time. There's a blur between what's real and what's not real.
Absolutely. So, like,
so you're working at this saying, prestigious. Oh, sorry.
No, yeah, of course. Like going to the culinary school to like get the. Let's pick back up on that.
Right. So I basically took this job offer at a fine dining restaurant, and I think we all know at the time fine dining was not really that.
Let's back up to that too. I don't get a good sense of how old you are. What time was this?
31. So I graduated high school in 2004. This was like 2007.
Okay.
2006, 2007.
It's a decade ago.
Yeah.
I mean,
I was basically trying to pay my way through that school without getting loans, and I got a small loan, but I was trying to also have jobs at the same time, so I wouldn't put myself too far in debt, because I had realized that it already did that for 2 years and like absolutely had nothing out of it. None of those courses transfer to computer, you know, like computer programming, calculus doesn't transfer to culinary, obviously. So I felt like I was already in a hole, so I wanted to try to work and kind of pay my way more through it, so I wasn't as far coming out of it as I was. So I got a job in a bar in Iowa City, Iowa, which is like
This is the other shoe dropping.
Yeah, right.
He got a job at a bar.
and that was, you know, I just wanted to pay my rent and, you know, fell in love with the drinks making side of it. And, you know, it was like the worst bar ever. It was so trashy. Like it was 19 plus in Iowa City to drink. So you could come into the bars at 19.
What?
We were very well known for being a 21st birthday bar, so you would have like a slew of underage kids and one person that had just turned 21.
Sounds like a fucking nightmare, man.
And our special was $20 or 25 pitchers for $20.
Opposite.
20 pitchers for $25.
20 pitchers?
Yes.
For $25.
On your birthday only. And
oh, on your birthday. I was like, is that every day? Holy shit.
Like I said, like, you know, there would be one person that was 21 and 23 people that weren't 21 that were like trying to drink all of this beer. And like, obviously we had to police that quite a bit.
I don't trust that. Like,
why on earth would a place let 19 years?
Like if a place has like dollar oysters and Kumamoto's or...
On the list.
I'm like,
something's suspect.
I don't trust that shit, man. Dude, I can't even think about running a bar and like liquor cost and beer cost. I can't even think of the cheapest, shittiest fucking beer that
would equal 20 pitchers for $25.
That's messed up, man.
So that was the bar I worked at, and it was, you know, it was great because it's high volume, and I learned that aspect, but it was, you know.
Well, that's
quite the opposite of the
It's an important part of it.
Yeah. Right. Oh, absolutely. You learn ergonomics and speed, which you were probably also kind of learning at culinary school as well, like mise en place, set yourself up for success, et cetera. Make a cockpit out of your station, all that jazz. But I'm curious, like, you know, we get a similar story from people all the time of like, oh, blah, 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 blah. And then I got a job at a bar and I fell in love with it. But you just said that same sentence or sentiment, at least. And then said that you worked at a place that sold 19-year-olds 20 pitchers for $25. What on earth did you fall in love with?
I mean, you
was
know.
It just the fucking adrenaline?
Right. I mean, at the time, you don't...
Sounds nonstop.
Right. You don't really know any better at the time. You get your first couple jobs and, you know, you might work at McDonald's or... My first restaurant job was Red Robin, and I thought it was amazing. And, like, if I went back I would probably hate it, right? Like... But at the time, it was, you know, it was romantic in a way, and all my friends could come in, and like, you know, I had friends that weren't 21 too, so they could still come in, like not like we would serve them, but it was definitely a place that felt more. You got a lot more reaction from people than a restaurant, than a fine dining restaurant. So it was like complete opposite sides of the spectrum. So I think that's, you know, it's cool when you're young to do it.
And, yeah, sure. It's a you know, like your friends are all looking up to you. Oh my God, he works over at the 21, the birthday place. Yeah, oh God, it's got to be the best job ever.
Right. And, you know, they'd come in from my hometown is about 45 minutes away. So even my friends that didn't go to school there would like drive up and we'd all hang out. And like, so it was cool for what it was at the time. And
absolutely.
It was fun.
Yeah, and it bit you. You got the bug there.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're just at the halfway mark. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back, and we do need to get diving into what I'm sure people are tuning in to hear about is The Office, because that's a pretty cool program. They got some cool junk over there. They got cool junk, man. They got 20 pitchers for $25. only on your birthday. ID required. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. We're going to come right back with Micah Melton and talk about the new office in New York City.
Don't go in for understanding when you are away. Can't use my heart to think away the time. In my room I will await you, and so soon I will relate you. And tie your finger right on up to mine. Sweet Josephine, you live in my dream.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
I'm not one for consolation, never second best. I'll practice till I get you right, my dear.
And we are back. You're listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. And we have Michael Melton from the Aviary, the Office, and Red Robin, as it turns out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What was the name of the pitcher joint?
One-Eyed Jake's.
Fuck you.
Of course it was.
Oh, man.
All right, so we're going to flash forward a little from One-Eyed Jake's and the Red Robin. Then you got a job at a bar in Chicago where you started, how did it get started over there? Your title was Ice Chef.
Right.
But that's not you didn't walk in as that position.
No, so I originally got hired to be one of the bartenders, essentially. So we all got hired, and then I started Alinea actually about 6 months before we opened. So I worked in the kitchen at Alinea for a while, which was amazing and, you know, another layer of cool experience. And then from there...
But you worked in the kitchen there?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah. Dude. So they kind of, they put us all in there just to learn the culture of the company and
run to that.
And try to kind of spread that as we were expanding. And we, you know, we would work in the kitchen from like 6 a.m. until 2 p.m. And then we'd go to, there was a little coach house next to it. And we would just make cocktails, classic cocktails over and over and over for, you know, 4 or 5 hours. We had a day where we literally made, I probably made 120 Sazeracs just nonstop. We talk about to this day, ruined the cocktail for me. But we just wanted to make sure we were all, you know, all of us had to have the exact same specs, build the exact same things. We were cooks at the time. And like,
sure,
for most of us, you know, like I was the only one that had any bartending experience from the opening team. So we wanted to, you know, if we walked into a party and someone found out we worked at the Aviary, them, you know, and they're like, "Oh, sweet, make me a Negroni." And one of the bartenders is like, "I don't know what that is. I'm just a cook." Like, you know, we wanted to kind of avoid that. I guess the thing we always said was walk before you run. So we wanted to make sure all of us knew it. And it was really cool.
So there was like a crossover between the front and back, if you will.
Yeah, like, right. Exactly. And so, like, you know, people that had never worked in kitchens.
I love it.
Before, you know, there was a guy whose only experience was Caribou Coffee. He'd never worked in food and beverage before, and he was like working a station in Alinea, which is, you know, like unheard of. The guy, his first restaurant job ever is at Alinea, 3 Michelin star. So that was cool, and it was good experience. And
three.
We learned we learned a lot, and we learned a lot really fast. And then we moved over, and part of that process was memorizing those cocktails and being able to kind of recite the recipes and have it all memorized was the best 5 people that did on the test. It was 86 classic cocktails, builds, brands, glassware, garnish, history. So the 5 people that did the best out of the 7 that were hired would be the 5 bartenders. And I actually was one of the 5 that made the cut. And a couple people, one person went to the kitchen and one person went downstairs and like kind of helped with the prep and stuff like that. But I was bartending for a couple weeks, and then right before we were about to open, the guy that was doing the ice at the time, actually, he walked out and took a lot of the recipes and kind of the stuff that he had been working on while we were upstairs working on the drinks. He just kind of left and took it all with him. So we were kind of at a stall where we really couldn't open unless we figured out how to do all this stuff that we kind of had promised to people at the time. So I offered to go down there and do it and try to catch it all back up. And so that's how I got down to the ice room, and it was great. You know, like I think taking a step back in that sense is like obviously why I got where I'm at. It's like, it didn't seem glamorous at the time, but then after we open, you realize that like, that is the glamour of the Aviary and the Office. Is like, it's not really about the actual making of the drink. It's about the process to get the drink to the guests. So it was cool to feel like I was a little nervous that I was going to like be down in the basement and never get any recognition. And then we opened and it was like, you know, every story was about the ice, or, you know, chef would bring people on tours and he'd show them the ice room. And like, so it felt good at the time.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. And you had, I read somewhere it was over 30 pieces of ice, 30 varieties. How do you even categorize that?
Yeah. So we started
styles. I don't know what's going on.
Right. We started, I think when we opened, we had like 26 or 28, and that's just like a flavor counts, a shape counts, a size counts, like hand chipped. If you have a sphere, you have a Collins piece, like those are all types, if you will. Even, you know, cold draft counts for us.
Sure.
But those are all in the production of the ice chef. So, you know, they maintain the machines, they clean all the machines and things like that, and then they freeze, make all the stocks, all of that stuff. So it's a bunch of different things kind of all in one.
Because stocks meaning like, you're making flavored waters to make right. into ice.
Exactly. Yeah.
That you then probably insert some garnish into while it's freezing as well. And of course those spheres that you've got your blast freezer happening and the balloons.
So, right. Yeah. So, you guys have like Kleinbell machines, stuff like that. So you're carving, cutting. So one of the main things that I know, I've not been to,
the office. I haven't been either.
I was just looking at you. I was like, wait a minute, what the fuck am I about to say? Like, we haven't been there, so we should go. But one of the very iconic things I know of from, it's either a linear or aviary, was the old fashioned where it's in a sphere of ice, and then it comes out to the table, and then whack it with a bar spoon,
right.
And then it comes like cracks and it just like kind of crumbles into a glass. Right,
the old fashioned in the rock.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what you called it in the beginning, right? But it's changed. It's morphed.
Yeah, it's actually an old fashioned in the rocks in Chicago, and here it's like it's kind of a cheesy story about New Year's, and inspired by the celebration in New York.
The ball dropping?
But yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah, God exactly. Damn it. Right. That's Aiden Bowie. You can thank him for that one.
But check it out what it is though. Cheeky. It's cool.
Yeah.
It's run it down.
So the drink now is it's basically three drinks in one. So we start with a little pour of champagne. So before New Year's, you have champagne. Then it's an old fashioned because right after New Year's, you want to turn up the volume a little bit and get your buzz on. So bourbon, scotch, green, Szechuan pepper. And the scotch and Szechuan are supposed to replicate smoke and the buzz in the air. And, you know, like, so there's this whole story about it. And then it's served on creme de cassis granita. So you get this kind of morning after Cure Royale sort of vibe from the end of the cocktail. So it's
a story, man.
Yeah, it's definitely a story. And, you know, that's
all we do.
Yeah,
stories.
Exactly.
Yeah, man.
That's the New York one. But yeah, the concept is, it's actually pretty simple when you think about it. It's just, well, a cool way to serve a
thoughtful
drink. Yeah, it's a cool way to serve a drink that's on the rocks instead of, you know,
how many,
just pouring over ice.
How many people are on the bar team here?
There's 14 drink makers, which is what we call them because they're not really tending a bar, and so we get a lot of slack for that, so we've always just called them drink makers. Then we have basically anywhere from like 2 to 5 people that do the prep. That's like batching, ice, syrups, juice, all that stuff. And then we have 4 bar managers and then myself. So it's 22 to 25. As a whole, the aviary in the office is 92 people.
How many seats in the office?
Office is 43 and the aviary is 93.
Wow.
Cool, man.
That's you know what I mean? Like, that's like old school, you know, like when I was younger and I was in culinary school, I would try and go to the fanciest restaurants that I could get to, and I remember going to like Russian service restaurants, you know, where there's a server for every guest.
Yeah, it's definitely that's fine insanity. Dining in style and style of service. So
that's insanity, but that's as Damon just said, you're telling a story, and that's where your story is, right? Like, like I'm at a bar that's completely the opposite. I'll be myself, literally 100% alone, up against 45 people at a time.
Right.
But that's the thing I sell. That's the story I'm trying to narrate. So over at the office, you've got this like really intimate thing happening that's intimate and intricate thing happening that the guest feels really pampered and cared for, and that can really show up in the drink itself, because it wasn't just one person making that drink as well as a dozen other drinks at the same time. It's one person making, it's two people making that drink, just that drink, yeah, right now, yeah, just for you. Yeah. Right? Right? That's insanity. Speaking of drinks, let's derail for 2 seconds. You brought us something in an unlabeled bottle that does not look new. What, you just bring this old junk from the closet?
Yeah, so we're, this is the speakeasy, so I thought it'd be good to bring a medicinal use only bottle from Prohibition. So, and I know you like Old Granddad.
I do.
As the story goes. So this is distilled 1917, bottled 1933, Old Granddad, bourbon, medicinal use only.
And where'd you acquire this one?
This was, so I bought from a guy in Kentucky, actually like 18 of these bottles, but I bought a personal one for myself, like kind of the ones that didn't have labels and things like that I'd bought for myself. So I brought this to New York with me just to kind of pour for friends and things like that. And it's the end of the bottle. It's going to start to go if we don't drink it, so.
Well, I guess we should probably do that then.
Yeah, let's drink a little bit of this. Let's get a... Thank you so much for bringing it for us. That's very kind of you to share. And it smells great.
Yeah. I kind of don't want to drink it. I want the smell.
Well, you've heard me rant and rave about that sort of thing. Like,
oh, man, this is great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it really is.
Very cool.
Very warming, too.
I've got a question from a listener.
Oh, rad. Wait, look at that. What, by Twitter?
No, just text, man.
Oh, okay, cool.
My friend Marco in Texas was asking with, hold on, I don't have my glasses on. okay, so with the culinary influence of the bar, what is your, basically asking like, what is the, what is your process with, and I think you kind of answered it a little bit earlier in the show, like as far as like, your classic specs. You said you would sit and hang out for like 4 or 5 hours and make like 120 Sazeracs.
Right.
The end of that question is, do you often check back in on your classic specs?
Yeah. Right. So I guess what the question maybe is you guys are making so many really forward thinking, cutting edge, innovative, thoughtful drinks. How often do you kind of go back and look at the, you know, can't
like a daiquiri or a Manhattan? Right. Or,
yeah. You know, like, can't carve ice if you can't cook rice. So how often do you go back to?
Yeah. To I the mean, basics. I guess restaurants and bars are, you know, we kind of look at it as there's nothing that is truly original. Everything is, you know, in
it's
cooking, it's French technique, and you know, like you might be the most forward thinking restaurant in the world, but at the end of the day, you still have to know how to make hollandaise. And that's kind of exactly how we look at it. We can do a whole lot of things, but at the end of the day, it's a bar, and the drinks have to taste good, and they have to be somewhat recognizable. Not every drink, but like if it's just so far out there that then you're just making drinks for yourself and not really making them for your guests. So it still has to be like grounded, I guess, in a way. And so that's why it's fun to do things like the In the Rocks, which are at the end of the day, it's just an old fashioned, you know, and it's. Exactly the way you would make an old fashioned. You would serve it at, you know, thousands of bars, but we add one extra thing to make it more aviary in a way. But it's an old fashioned at the base. So I guess that's kind of what we always do is try to remind ourselves that at the end of the day, it's still a bar, and there needs to be some foundation for it, and not just throwing stuff at a wall and seeing what sticks.
Right. Sure. Can you like look at a drink that's on the menu and like sort of trace it back and go like, oh, in the end, this is a Negroni style cocktail.
Oh yeah. Like, I mean, everything.
Like it's like mother sauce. You mentioned hollandaise, which is a mother sauce. So it's like, there's all these mother sauces. There's only 5 mother sauces. All sauces are derivative of those.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of the same in the cocktail world, but it's more like 8.
Yeah.
You can definitely categorize everything in terms of, you know, what it is and how it was, at least what it came from, and it might not necessarily be completely recognizable as that, but if we write the ingredients down on the paper, it'll make sense.
The question that's rolling around in my head, though, is, and I love that you guys would stand around and crush through whatever, 100 or so cocktails. You know, that's the Bruce Lee quote that I love, which is, he said famously, "I don't fear the man who practices 10,000 punches one time each. I fear the man who practices one punch 10,000 times." Right, so I can see that's the goal. You're looking for that muscle memory. You're looking for that recognition. That
did taste, you really just fucking quote Bruce Lee on the show?
I use that quote all the time.
My first time to hear that.
I don't think I've used it on the show.
Go on. I appreciate it.
You get it, though, right? Like, thank you. He's bowing over there. It's like, Shaolin. I need to... Okay, Dave. I'm curious to know, where did all that product go? Were you just making Sazeracs and dumping them down the sink?
Oh, yeah.
Good Lord, man.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you at least, like, just dump them all into a Cambro and put them in a barrel and have a barrel-aged blended multiple-piece Sazerac? I don't know, something.
I think at the time, you know...
You guys need to open a sidebar so you just take over the drainage.
Yeah. I think at the time, you know, all the managers from Alinea, you know, all the sous chefs and front house managers and stuff were the ones that we were making the drinks for. So they probably had a couple, and then, you know... 4 Sazeracs in, they're probably like, all right, I don't want any more of this.
Yeah.
I'll take a sip and see if it's right and then get rid of it.
Right. But then just drink
some Malort and some...
Yeah, exactly, in Chicago.
Red wine dynamite.
Right, yeah.
I mean, to me, like, the whole idea of, like, Alinea Aviaria, like, it's all very, like, the idea of, like, what I understand of it is all very, like, very thoughtful... in the process and production of these drinks. Like, so much so that you've won, like, tons of awards for the cocktail program. And to me, I love that. I love that. It's super important. I'm kind of wondering, like, where things like this, we're having this great, like, old whiskey and
delicious.
Got like these great grandiose like productions of cocktails and servingware and garnish and just like not even just that, it's beyond like servingware and garnish, it's like holy shit, man, like this comes out on a this plate gets dropped on a pillow filled with lavender air,
right?
And then as it compresses the pillow, it, you know, like,
yeah,
that's a thing that they do.
I know, yeah,
yeah. Like, yeah, but like, so
wake and bake.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah,
it's everything bagel here.
I read about it.
So, as a bartender, as someone who creates drinks, as a bar manager, I'm trying to like find my words here because like I'm just like totally like transfixed by these ideas that I see from like and hear about from these places. And I'm not trying to say, like, do you just drink Budweiser and shots, like, after a shift? But, like, is it exploratory? Is it, like, hospitality? Like, what is the drive for you guys? And
yeah, is there, like, a company ethos or motto that you can like, boil into like, two sentences?
Like a Danny Meyer kind of, like, setting the table vibe? Like,
yeah, I mean, I guess, like...
Is that something that, like, no one ever talks about with this group? I've never heard anyone talk about...
True.
Like a... Like
I think the message seems clear to me. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. But, like,
yeah.
I think the message is, in both food and drink at these places that you operate, it's all about being... a surprise and a delight to the guest at the same time being a satisfactory experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's... I can surprise you. It may not be delightful. I can delight you and it may not be a surprise. And I can do both of those things and still not be a satisfactory experience. But I think that's the tie-in, right? So you get the three-prong approach.
Yeah, and it's exactly that. It's a drink that tastes good at the end of the day, so it's satisfactory. But then we add the other layer, which is an aroma or a visual or, you know, things like that, some interactivity or whatever it is. And that's kind of, I guess, the mentality of Alinea as well. And so it's very creative in a sense. We also push each other because, you know, like Alinea just went viral for clear pumpkin pie. And it's like, you know, I distilled pumpkin in 2011, pumpkin pie in 2011, trying to make a drink with it and completely failed and it was terrible. And then, you know, they all they do is put it on crust and it's like, the most amazing thing ever. And it, you know, so there's this kind of like, I guess between us, there's a little bit of competition just to come up with new things and new exciting things and kind of share that. And also like we bounce stuff off each other all the time. And like the lavender pillow is a good example of that. That's an Alinea serve that we brought over to Aviary and applied it to cocktails. And like, you know, it's cool. We've been doing it forever. If you look at it, but also we took it and reapplied it kind of to our thing, which is a drink. So,
what about service itself? There's no actual bar, right? You sit at table.
Yeah, so the aviary is no, there's not a bar you can walk up to. Part of what allows us to do what we do is the setup. So it's a really expensive piece of custom steel that is the bar. So, you know, there's 12 glass drawers that are all freezers, and each station is like kind of its own cockpit. So also not having a bar kind of eliminates the distraction in a way of, you know, people coming up and waving money at you and things that you deal with regularly, yeah. Right? And so you kind of get to focus a little bit more and be a little more involved in the process of the drink.
And you're basically plating a cocktail.
Yeah, right. And it's definitely not something that works at every bar, and it's pretty unique for us. But it is what it is, and that's, you know,
how does that,
like, kind of our thing.
Wondering how that makes you feel as a bartender. Like, if someone has like been across the bar from customers, and then all of a sudden you don't have customers across from you, and you have like all the focus on these cocktails,
yeah.
Right? Like, it must be a massive change of pace, and like, not maybe not pace, but like just like your like mentality in your zone, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's when we hire people, it's the first conversation we have is like, look, this is not a traditional bar. You don't get the interaction. There's a little bit less creativity.
You're a bar chef, basically.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people love it. Some people absolutely hate it. You know, like, people walk in and are like, wait, where are the guests? I don't get to talk to people. Like, you know, so it's definitely for some people and not for some people, but I think
a lot of bartenders that really thrive on that instant gratification of like being part of the experience with the guests.
Right.
And some don't. And then there are people who can kind of do both, you know, like there are those people who work at maybe a high volume restaurant bar, and some nights they're on point and sometimes they're on service. So some nights they don't speak to a single guest. Sometimes they speak to all of them. Right. So
the balance would be like doing that. And then having like two nights a week, and then having like two shifts behind like a crazy dive bar.
Yeah.
Like
BCC.
Like Delilah's or something
for $25.
Like that.
With ID.
That'd be amazing.
So what I was going to say is, I feel like, and again, I haven't been to either the Chicago office or here in New York, but I feel like there's probably a preconceived notion of how that sounds not intimate, but the more I think about it and the more I listen to you describe some of the drinks and some of the process, I feel like it sounds to me like it's a very intimate thing, right? So it's pretty rare, I'm assuming, that you go to this place alone. So you're at a table with someone you know and love, probably, and then these things keep coming over to your table, and you get to experience it with that person, and maybe to some degree the person who's carrying it over and displaying the serve, right?
Yeah, and I mean, you definitely...
And it's like a show. Every drink is like a show, and no one orders all the same drinks in the same order, so everybody's show is different.
Yeah. And you get a kind of experience with the people around you, too, and one really cool thing about it that we never thought about until now is, like, people don't order based on what's in our drinks. People order, like, it's like the fajita effect,
monkey see,
you know?
Monkey do.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So it walks
sizzling.
Through, and they can care less that it has tequila in it, and they've never drank tequila since college or whatever it is, and they're like, I want it. I don't care what's in it. And so people kind of like open themselves back up, which is cool.
I experienced that a lot at kind of like the same vibes over it. Like when I was working at ZZ's Clam Bar.
Sure.
It was like there were no bar stools, but you were, as a bartender, you're kind of on display with the rest of the booze. But there's only like 13 seats or whatever. But people would order drinks based on the vessels, yeah.
He's got all that copperware. That's before.
You didn't
before,
really get to talk
before
to
it got
customers.
Co-opted by big brands,
right?
don't want to get into that. Yeah.
but yeah, and also, to be fair, it was brass.
Sorry, brassware. That's right. You're right.
Then it was copper. But yeah, man, it was kind of a trip, man. Like working behind that bar, so I understand like what it. I can kind of understand what it's like, you know, working behind these bars. Because you're basically like you were just in production, you know, and you're part of the production, you know. And
Well, at the office, it's you guys. The what'd you call them? Drink makers. The drink makers are all behind glass. They can be seen, right?
Yeah, the
kind of like we are here on the studio. Right. People can see us through this big pane glass window, but
they
can't really interact with us too much, other than the wave or the nod, or I can salivate over this woman's pizza.
the office has an actual bar inside of it, so there are bartenders in the office.
And is it the same style of service in there?
No, so that's a speakeasy in a way. So it's a lot of vintage spirits and kind of old school. It's like the aviary is focused on the presentation and how the drink looks and being complex in that way. And then the office is more classic and more complex in the flavors that are in the glasses. So there's an actual bar in there. You can sit in the office and sit at the bar. And so that's definitely the solo guest kind of area, because it's, you know, it's more traditional in a way. But that's our kind of like, it's our balance for the aviary, which makes it like, it allows us to do it, because then, you know, especially in the hotel, people walk up and really want a martini or want a Manhattan, and we don't have it on the menu in the aviary. We have the ability to do that in the office. So that's kind of our tipping point. Yeah. Yin to our yang.
Do you, or are you able to go off menu? Like if someone walks in and they say, oh, I see the Wake and Bake or whatever it's called. I see the thing in the rocks. I just want that Sazerac. I know you made 120 of them in 4 hours. I want one of those Sazeracs.
Right. Yes and no. It depends on the presentation. Like the porthole, we can't just dump anything into. But yeah, we could shoot anything into and in the rocks. But at the same time, like it's people give us the leeway to not have to do that necessarily, because people come in
they
want
to come to do the thing. Yeah, yeah.
And so they're, a lot of people are kind of so taken back that they're just like ready kind of like to take themselves out of their comfort zone, which is cool. But in a hotel, we kind of experienced what we never did in Chicago, which is people coming in and not knowing who we are, what we're doing. So that's actually, it's been kind of refreshing to like really remind ourselves that at the end of the day, it's still a bar. So if someone orders something, we do our best to make it happen, as long as it's something that's not crazy. Like, it's like, you don't walk into a restaurant.
As long as it's something not crazy.
you don't walk into a fine dining restaurant and go, this is a restaurant, I want a pizza. Yeah. It's like, yeah. If it's a fine dining restaurant, there's a certain
cheeseburger. Don't order a hamburger at the sushi bar. I get it.
So, but if it's, you know, something we have the ability to do, obviously we'll do it. It's hospitality at the end of the day. So
exactly. That's pretty amazing, man. And I think I definitely need to find a spare evening, which is, that's not going to happen.
It never
not
happens.
It will in January. The book is what's chewing up all my nights. As soon as January comes, deadlines are over. It's done or it's done. That's it. Whatever. Like, there's a part of me that's like so excited for that.
So I get my Souther back.
Yeah, man. Exactly. We're gonna hang out. Other than the 45 minutes we hang out here once a week.
All right.
Well, tell us. I feel like I haven't exhausted all my questions, but maybe just give me some insight or enlightenment on something you'd like to talk about the program or the bar itself or your experience here in New York or any of it.
Yeah, I mean, New York's been great. It makes Chicago feel really small, which is weird. You know, I never would have expected. I've visited a lot, but it's just once you actually get here and then you realize how long it takes to commute and like how far these places actually are apart, it's like makes Chicago feel so small, which has been kind of eye-opening in a way. But this is like really cool for us, you know, like we've all Chicago at this point, and like New York is the best of the best. So it's cool to be in kind of we were a small fish in a small pond, and now we're kind of a small fish in a big pond. And
very modest
small fish.
Well, when you look at the grand scheme of how many, you know, how many bars in New York are on the 50 best bars list and how many win, you know, numerous awards that you can talk about and over and over. And the aviary is not at least not yet, never been on that caliber or with that caliber in the same market. So like there's a little bit more of a friendly competition now. Like, you know, I kind of want to take the Nomad down. Like I want that spot. I want to be the best bar in New York now. And that's really cool because it's totally friendly competition and everyone's been really, really nice to us. And it's been cool.
So let's talk about that then for a second. We're going to run long, obviously. Let's talk about that for a second. Can you name a couple of spots you've been while you've been in New York that you think were exemplary or that like really caught your attention? Or
yeah, I mean,
and that could be anything from, you know, I always tout the fact that I'm glad that there's a spectrum. You know what I mean? I'm glad that One Eyed Jacks exists. You know,
and One Eyed Jakes,
Jakes, whatever it was, doesn't matter. Listen, when you're friends, he's Jack. When you're his friend, you know, and I'm glad that the office exists, and I'm glad that there's everything in the middle as well. So,
right.
Is there a bar or even a restaurant that you've had a great experience at that you're like, holy shit, this is what New York is, or this is what bartending is, or?
I mean, that's why I said the Nomad. That's like, you know, especially for us, it applies really well. You know, they have a 3 Michelin star restaurant, 11 Madison Park, and that was their first bar. It's a bar inside of a hotel. It's a union property. Like, it's very. It falls in line a lot with what we're trying to do. And
are you union over there?
Yeah, it's union. Oof. Yeah. But they've done an incredible job. And that place is like as consistent as it gets. And you go there and the food is amazing and the drink is amazing. And like the Scotch service, olives. The people that work there. Those things are awesome. Constantly surprising. Like last time I went in there, they had an 8-seat like little Japanese highball bar.
Oh, in the back, outside, yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah. What's it called? Standing room?
Right.
Yeah. In Japanese, I don't know the word.
And they just keep doing it, and they keep getting better, and like it's really inspiring. And you know, they're good friends of our group too. So that's the spot, I think, for me. But you know, it's New York. Like there's tons of places that are like legendary, that you know, and never get worse. They just continue to get better with age. So it's really cool scene to be part of, for sure.
Yeah. Or I think it's a great addition to the pantheon here in New York to have your team over and have the things that you're doing, you know, again, like really surprise and delight and make people feel, I don't know, special. I feel like that's the vibe that I'm getting off of everything you're talking about. If I get a seat there, I feel like I'm going to feel special.
Yeah.
Speaking of getting seats, is it reservation? Is it walk-in? How's it go?
So we have both for sure. We sell tickets. So another kind of interesting thing that we do is...
Oh, is it via Talk? Didn't your company create Talk?
Yeah. So
I went to a talk in New Orleans about that.
Yeah. Talk is it's tickets for restaurants. So the same way you would buy a ticket to go to a Springsteen show, you buy a ticket to come to one of our restaurants, because at the end of the day, like people...
Is Springsteen there?
Maybe. We'll see. Depends on the night. But, it's like people make 100 reservations and then cancel half of them.
Yeah,
and the
exactly.
business struggles because of it. It just doesn't make any sense. So Talk has like cured a lot of that. It's really good for us too, because people can, you know, they can book deposits. It basically is just $20. That just guarantees that you show up. If you don't show up, it's $20 out of your bank account. But it all comes off your bill at the end. So it's not like it's more of a deposit than it is anything.
It's a guarantee, you know? yeah
and so it's good for us, and it makes sure people show up and show up relatively on time. And but that's the aviarynyc.talktix.com. that's reservations, but it's, again, it's inside of a hotel, so we try to keep a decent amount of tables open for hotel guests when they walk down, that they're not totally out of luck. So we have some tables, and we have a lot more wiggle room here than we do in Chicago, which is nice.
Sure.
It's a little bit bigger too.
Which hotel are you in?
It's in the Mandarin Oriental, which is on 60th in the Time Warner building.
Right.
So, and the view is like unbelievable. It's on the 35th floor. It looks out over Central Park. It's a completely unobstructed view. So it's one of the best, I think one of the best restaurant bar views probably in the world. So it's unbelievable.
Rad. And you have a lot of great neighbors in that building too.
Yeah. Yeah, we get a lot of love from
a few places to eat and drink in that hotel.
Right.
How about yourself? You got an Instagram you want to pump, or where are you? Where can we find you on the world wide web?
Yeah. So I'm at Micah Melton, MICAHMELTON. That's Twitter, Instagram. And then we do have a book coming out as well. So we're in the process of trying to finalize that.
Are you writing it on an iPhone?
I'm writing a lot of it on my iPhone, actually.
Yeah, I'm writing mine right here. That's all I have.
So we had a couple called the Hembergers who read the Alinea cookbook and then decided to write a book about cooking through the book, which was actually, I think, a little bit better than the actual Alinea book. Crazy.
Awesome.
And they, you know, they're like, it's unbelievable that basically we pried them out of their jobs in movie production to kind of come work with us, and they're geniuses, and they're, you know, their photos and all that stuff are unbelievable. So the book's going to be awesome.
And what's it called?
It's going to be the Aviary.
Just call it the Aviary.
100 plus recipes from the Aviary, the office, and lots of photos, and it's all self-published, which is cool. So we've done a lot of work.
That's
to try
part
to,
of the ethos of your company as well. It's like we do everything for ourselves, right?
I mean, at this day, like, I guess bartenders and cooks have been taken advantage of by brands and companies for so many years. It's refreshing to like kind of put your foot down and be like, no, we're just going to do it ourselves then. And that's book publishers as well. You know, like it's hard to get a good deal and do it the right way if you don't do it yourself, because it's just not, the contracts are just not beneficial. So it's interesting for sure. It adds a lot of layers, but it adds a lot of control at the same time too. So I think it's good.
Right. Damon, you got anything further? I'm going to look at the calendar real fast.
I'm just really excited about this book.
I'm excited about the whole thing.
And we need to book a date. Like, we'll you know, get it on talk, and we'll go over to the office, man. And you know, it's been a while. Like, we're actually we're in book season right now, so a lot of our guests have been bringing out books and stuff. But like, it's and that's very exciting. I'm always excited for this time of year, mm-hmm. just in general, really, because it's my favorite time of year to like create drinks, like. I love getting into the spice cabinet. You know, it's like, this is a great time of year to get into cocktails. It's like stirred boozy bitter, which I know you're not very familiar
yeah.
with, right?
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Yeah, but it's really cool to like talk about both of those things. It's, Mike, it's been really great having you on the show, man. This is really awesome. Cool.
Yeah,
and bringing that. I don't get to Chicago very often, so I'm glad you brought it out here. And I'm sad to see you go, you know, at the end of the year. But, you know, like you said before, it's a really good time to go visit Chicago, you know, in January. So,
yeah. Right when the plows come out. Yeah.
But, yeah, man, thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate it. And also,
thanks
again,
for this delicious whiskey.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You really know. Appreciate that. Super great having you on, and I feel like we could continue. So,
yeah,
so
we should have you back on.
Exactly, is let us know when you're going to be back in town, and we can keep talking Souther, about what's going on.
Speaking
next.
Of, who do we have coming up over the next couple months?
Coming up, we have let's see, Bianca from Uncouth Vermouth is going to be here. She's launching her own Amaro. We got Sammy Ross from obviously from Attaboy Diamond Reef, Attaboy Nashville, his project out in Vegas. Like a lot of stuff going on with him. NYDC's Alan Katz, the team from Jupiter Disco, which is Al and Max, Willie Shine. We've got Maggie Hoffman coming up not too distant future. Going to talk about her new book. Speaking of books, did I say Giuseppe Gallo already? He's going to be on talking about Italicus in his very rich Italian accent. So lots of cool people coming up. So plenty of great shows to tune into and listen to. So
yeah. It's looking like a. It's looking like a great end of the year and beginning of the next year for us.
Yeah.
Here at the Speakeasy.
Yeah. Should mention before we cut away that
our fundraiser
is next Monday at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. Love to have you buy
Beautiful
a ticket
place.
And come out there and have some drinks made by Damon and I with a bunch of cool sponsors.
We haven't actually bartended together in quite some time.
It's been a while.
So for all of our listeners out there, if you want to come by and
watch a couple of knuckleheads bump into each other, then go over to the office afterwards. Come on over if you can. If you can't, if you can come over, there's going to be lots of cool raffles and silent auctions as well as a live auction, I believe. Trying to raise money for the network so that all of our shows can stay on the air. If you can't make it to that, please go to our website and click on the Beating Heart so that you can donate to keep Heritage Radio Network, a nonprofit organization. Pumping out great shows just like this one with great guests like Micah Melton from The Office.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Again, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Let's clink some glasses, man.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Cheers, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That's it for the Speakeasy this week. Tune in to Heritage Radio Network for many more programs like this one. Until next week, cheers.
Cheers, guys.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil wants his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Yeah.